This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support. So if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Jenny Langley, an advocate in the eating disorder community. After supporting her son through anorexia 20 years ago, Jenny has dedicated her life to making sure families feel informed, empowered, and never alone. For over 15 years, Jenny has worked with the Eating Disorder Research Team at the Institute of Psychiatry and is trained in the New Maudsley model, where she now coaches carers, trains clinicians, and delivers practical skills workshops. She is the co-author of the New Maudsley Skills-Based Training Manual and writer of Boys Get Anorexia 2. A book that has helped countless families feel seen. Jenny's work continues to remind us that carers matter, families matter, and compassionate support can change lives. I really enjoyed this week's episode with Jenny, hearing all about her experience of supporting her son with an eating disorder, and then the New Maudsley approach, which supports carers and understanding the importance of ensuring that carers feel seen in their struggles, to know that they're not alone and there's always support for them as well as for their loved ones. Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast. Today I am joined by Jenny Langley, who founded the New Maudsley Approach, which is a method for helping parents and carers support people with an eating disorder. So I'm very, very honoured to have you, Jenny. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good, Hannah. I just want to say I didn't found the New Maudsley Approach. I was part of the research, and I have led the way in terms of making sure that it's as accessible as possible today, because it was never really rolled out in the NHS in the way that we at first envisaged. And that's often the case, isn't it? So I have spent the last 20 years making sure as many families can benefit from the New Maudsley Approach as possible.
You know, when I said founded, I was like, I know that's wrong. I was like, what do I do now? So that's absolutely fine. Thank you so much for clarifying. Would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, hi. So I call myself a recovered chartered accountant. So when my son developed anorexia back in 2002, like many families, it was just a shock, like a bolt out of the blue. We didn't know what had hit us. We didn't really know anything about eating disorders. And he was so ill so quickly. And I always say, actually, we were lucky because he was admitted to a general adolescent unit within 12 weeks of starting to lose weight. So it was really, really, really quick. And the NHS saved his life. So it was a general unit that had really good experience of eating disorders. And it was a very traumatic experience for him and for us. And we had such a steep learning curve. And we didn't meet any really like-minded families. It was so tough. And just, you know, by coincidence, it was when Janet Treasure and her team at the Maudsley was starting to think about this model for carers. So I didn't benefit from any of that while he was ill. We kind of just had to muddle through. But then I wanted to give something back. And after writing about our story, so I wrote the book Boys Get Anorexia Too, I was introduced to Professor Janet Treasure and her team. So I was one of the carer guinea pigs for the whole carer model. And it's amazing. I just kept thinking, gosh, if we'd had this, things could have been easier. Anyway, he did go on to make a full recovery and he's now 35 and he's going to be a daddy next year. So isn't that lovely?
That's absolutely what wonderful. I love that when people have been through an eating disorder and hearing their recovery stories and the positives. I think that's so, it brings so much hope to people that are still struggling now to know that there is a life beyond an eating disorder.
Totally. And even when he was, he was 14 when the book was published, and he said, if one other family benefits, it will have all been worthwhile. And I celebrate his life every day, and I'm so proud of him.
Well, that is absolutely lovely. And we'll get on to the new Maudsley approach maybe in a bit, but I would really like, it's not often, I guess, that we hear from people that have supported somebody through an eating disorder what it was like for them in the moment, because I think often we hear what it's like to maybe live with an eating disorder, but not the reality of supporting someone. So I wonder if you would mind sharing.
Yeah, it's the biggest thing is the shock. Like, how is this happening to our family? Because it doesn't obviously just affect the person, the individual, does it? It affects the whole family. How has this happened? And I did the massive guilt trip. You feel so much guilt and shame that you must have, as a mother, you must have done something wrong. That you just lie awake night after night after night thinking, why didn't I see this earlier? What could I have done differently? And of course, it's wasted energy, but it doesn't feel like wasted energy because it's almost like your human brain has to go through that process of just checking in with yourself. But it's so debilitating and you feel so disempowered. So, in the same way that the person with the eating disorder might go through a period of denial, you do as a carer, you're like, this cannot be happening. And then you have that dawning realization, oh, this is real. This is our new world. This is our truth. And you lose hope. You lose hope so quickly. You just feel like you're being sucked into this vortex. So I always say we felt like we were in this great big bath and somebody had pulled out the big plug hole and we were just being sucked down into this plug hole and there was nothing we could do about it. And of course there was, and we did. And as I said, it was a really steep learning curve. But it is that to start with, it's the shock, the denial, the guilt, the shame, the anger. Like, how could this happen to us? A whole cocktail of really, really, really desperate emotions. You just feel despair. Like you cannot imagine. You cannot imagine if you've never cared for someone with an eating disorder. You cannot possibly imagine the reality of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, it's such an important thing to discuss because, as I said before, I think so often we talk about the person struggling with the eating disorder. But I know in my experience, my eating disorder impacted every single element of my life. And so, as part of that, it's not only impacting the relationship that you have with your parents or the loved ones around you, but those people that are living with you and care for you, it massively impacts them as well because, like you said, that despair of what the hell can I do? And I don't know about you, but I know for my mum, her mentality, particularly at the start, was very much, well, I'm your mum, I can fix everything.
Totally. It's just the human instinct. And, I would say to my son, Sam, you're a really clever boy. You just need to eat more and exercise less, and everything will be fine. And then I realized very quickly that the more I argued with the eating disorder, the more it just enforced those eating disorder thoughts. And he would be quite cheeky and sassy and kind of say back to me, well, no, mum, I'm fine. You need to eat less and exercise more. Look at the size of your ass, So, yeah, cheeky, cheeky little boy he was. And we can laugh about it now. But back then, it just felt impossible. It just felt, there's a book called The Castle of Glass by Ian Burns, I think. And one of the quotes in that is like, what happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable feast? And that's what it felt like, because I felt like I must be an unstoppable force. I'm his mum. I'm a chartered accountant. I'm a city stockbroker. I can fix him. And he was this immovable feast. It's like not, there was not going to be one iota of wiggle room. And we ended up calling it Rex. And to start with, Rex was his ally, Rex was his friend. And then he gradually started to realize, oh, actually, Rex has become a bully. And that's when we could really start to connect with him rather than always feeling like that we felt like we were battling him. And that's such a horrible feeling because you wake up in the morning and you've got, oh my goodness, I've got to manage this beast that's living with us at the moment. And you feel like you hate your son, and that's a horrible, horrible thing because you don't hate your son. You hate what's happened. You hate the illness. But it doesn't, in that moment, it feels like you hate your child, and it's just it's indescribable, honestly, it is.
Yeah. And I think that's actually a really interesting perspective, what you've just described there, because I know I very much felt that the initial point when you develop the eating disorder, for me, it very much felt like a friend and it had my back and it was, on my side sort of thing. It does cause that separation between you, the person struggling with the eating disorder, and the eating disorder, and then their loved ones. But that's interesting what you said about how, as time went on, and your son started to realize maybe it was more of a foe than a friend, that was when you were able to connect. Am I getting that right?
Totally. Well, we could connect, but we still couldn't fix him. So, he would say, I know that Rex is a bully, but he's got a hook in my head now, Mum. Like, I can't just take him out of my head. Like, he's really, really embedded in my head. And but just him being able to verbalize that was such a relief that he'd started to have some insight that we were all trying to help him. We weren't all trying to, imprison him and punish him. And I know to start with, I mean, no wonder he was flat on his back in hospital on bed rest. He wasn't allowed to see his mates. He wasn't allowed to do anything that it gave him joy. It felt like pure punishment. And particularly the regime, when he was first in the hospital, it's like I looked at the timetable and I thought, this is just meals. So, and the meals are the thing that scare him the most at the moment. So what they're doing is they're breaking his will. Because his will, his spirit, believes that he shouldn't be eating this food, and he's being forced to eat this food 6 times a day. And he'd be hauled out of bed, down to the dining table, face the food. There'd be a certain amount of time for the food, and then he'd be sat at the table for a while because then they would take him back up to his bed. I mean, no wonder it felt like punishment. It felt like he was a caged bird. It was just it was so traumatizing. And in fact,
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces, Gucci bags, Prada heels, but my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal, game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
Interestingly, now he started to talk a little bit more about, not that he doesn't remember all of this stuff, he doesn't, but he's starting to talk about, sometimes he feels a bit wobbly, and that to me is a sign that his brain is starting just to, like, he's now of an age where he can start to process some of that. I don't know if you went through something similar, Hannah, with your journey.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting one. I have like black spots in my memory where I just kind of my mum will say something, about something. I'm like, I don't remember
Really? Yeah,
that.
really.
Did we do that? Like, I can't remember. And it makes sense, doesn't it? Ultimately, if you're not eating enough to kind of help your body to function, then your body's not going to prioritize making memories and retaining information. Did that approach to treatment work for your son?
It did. Yeah, it
Did.
did break his will. It was brutal. But today he would have just been nasogastric fed. Yeah. So I'm grateful that they did that, And I know, I do a whole session for carers around nasogastric feeding, and I Sarah Fuller's one of my best friends, who's the most amazing dietitian, who's done all the research and led all the guidelines around nasogastric feeding, because there was such a postcode lottery, wasn't there? But it is a very kind of traumatizing intervention, and we went the other way in COVID, didn't we? Because of so many patients being in the pediatric wards, and they wouldn't know what else to do if the child wouldn't eat, would they? Would be, let's go for the nasogastric feeding. But it was so rare back in 2002. It worked, but it was brutal. So in a different way, it was brutal. And things like he would say, so he was only 12 years old. He would say, I'll only eat if my mum comes to visit. But they were very, very strict about visitation. So we could only go, I think it was only Monday night and Thursday night for an hour to start with. That was the only visiting at that in that you know in that engagement kind of like period, and so he would want me to go more, obviously. I would want to go every day, because in a pediatric ward you'd be with them all the time, wouldn't you? But that wasn't how they worked, and they would say, no, that's not how it works, Sam. When you've eaten, then we'll allow your mum to come. So it was brutal, but for him it worked. Could there have been a different way? Maybe. I don't know.
And I think this is the thing, isn't it? That to me sounds extraordinarily traumatic. But maybe that was the approach that your son needed, and unfortunately might not be the approach for some people, which I think is why, often we need to kind of think about what's in somebody's best interest. But I'm just in terms of that, how did you feel not being able to see your son?
I'm just crying now. I mean, it's horrible, it's awful, but we accepted it, because when we first dropped him off, and there was an amazing, amazing psychologist called Dodo. She was so compassionate and so kind, and I went in with my chartered accountant nerdy geek head with 10,000 questions, and she answered a lot of them. And then she said, I'm going to stop you now, Jenny. I know you want all these answers. And she said, we won't have all these answers. And she said a couple of things that were really, really, really valuable. And the first one was, she said, well, she said three things. She said, your son's exhausted. So he was sat there. I mean, he was just not engaged at all. That kind of trance face. So he was kind of just sat there, almost falling asleep in the chair. And she said, your son's exhausted. He just needs some really intensive intervention that we will give him, and we need to help him to reset. And then she said, I just want you to know, Jenny, that you're not the only dysfunctional family. In fact, she said, all families are dysfunctional, which was so helpful. You can't see Hannah on the podcast, but her face was a picture just then. Like, no, because it sounds awful, doesn't it? Saying you're not the only family that's dysfunctional. And we were dysfunctional in that moment, because we were paralyzed by the eating disorder. But she said, all families are dysfunctional. You know that, Jenny. And I'm like, oh, I hadn't thought of that before. And then, so that was really liberating, actually. And then she said, the most important thing is that we look forward, not back. And she said, in all likelihood, we'll never know what caused this. There'll be some genetic backdrop, there'll be some environmental triggers, there'll be just a perfect storm of things that have led Sam to be here today. If there is anything that we need to process, it'll come out through some of the interventions that we do. But what I urge you to do, Jenny, is look forward, not back. And of course, the whole new Maudsley model is about that. It's about, not what caused an eating disorder, because we never really know, but what is keeping it going. So could families all dance a little bit differently? And part of the program was family therapy, which was deeply uncomfortable. Like, it was really not at all what I'd expected. I thought it would be light and fluffy and airy fairy, and it was hard. And my husband would be really just like jiggling around, looking out the window, thinking about the cricket score. Sam's younger brother would be drawing on a piece of paper. He was only 9 at the time. And I ended up talking about my mum. But so it felt so intrusive. And Sam would sit there with this stony face, just like, this is rubbish, this is rubbish, this is rubbish. And but what we learn is that we were all in a dance, and we were all going to dance a little tiny bit differently. So it wasn't about fixing Sam. It wasn't just Sam's journey. It was us as a family. So that's the whole systemic family model, isn't it? It's us as a family. It's that we're just all going to move a little tiny bit differently, and that's what's going to make a difference. And that is basically the new Maudsley model.
Wow. Yeah, and I think that's such an interesting thing that you said there in terms of it's not just Sam's journey, because I think from two perspectives there, a lot of the time when families are supporting someone with an eating disorder, the focus is solely on the individual and the individual getting better, and everyone kind of forgets about their own well-being.
Yeah,
But equally,
totally, yeah.
in the same respect, people only focus on the actions of the person with the eating disorder, but it's kind of, as you so nicely put, that dance between
Yeah.
not putting the blame or responsibility on a single person, but working on it together.
Totally. Yeah. And in the new Maudsley approach, we obviously have the animal metaphors, which is a really l lovely, light-hearted way for families to be reflecting on how am I responding at the moment? Is it working? Because there's no such thing as a wrong animal or a right animal. If it's working, carry on doing it. If it's not working, then we can try something else. And I was all of the animals that they'd noticed that, that they did then notice in the research. So I was the logical rhino, I was the protective kangaroo, I was the very upset jellyfish, the nagging terrier. Sometimes I was the ostrich putting my head in the sand, and it's not that there's a formula that works for any family. It's the family's ability to think, we're a bit stuck here, or that really backfired. And then next time, what would I do a little bit differently? And then we have our lovely metaphors for the pod of dolphins and the St. Bernard. So shall I quickly explain those because they're so powerful?
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely.
So with the St. Bernard, people get the St. Bernard wrong because I always say to a group of carers, what does the St. Bernard do in the face of any avalanche? And they immediately say the St. Bernard goes right in to rescue. I say, well, actually, is that true? Because what the St. Bernard does is it waits for the avalanche to pass. So think about, a huge blow up to do with the eating disorder. So you learn to pause. So the St. Bernard waits for the danger to pass and then goes into, and I always say to support rather than rescue, the St. Bernard then goes into support because the St. Bernard then is in a very strong position to be able to give that support. And what does the St. Bernard have around its neck? A casket of rum, brandy, whiskey, something warming. And I always say to carers, that represents your self-care toolkit. So you always have that casket. Even if you're only tapping into that casket for 5 minutes a day, because lots of carers don't even think about their own well-being for 1 minute a day, let alone 5 minutes a day. Even for 5 minutes a day, it just tops up your own resources a little bit. And the St. Bernard is calm and warm and compassionate and cuddly and, strong and provides a lovely kind of scaffold for the family, doesn't it? But within a scaffold, there's always a bit of wiggle room. So then we have the pod of dolphins. So the pod of dolphins swimming along, and one of the dolphins goes out into the danger zone. And somebody's in the pod, not necessarily mum or dad, often will be mum or dad. They'll swim outside the dolphin and gently start to nudge that dolphin back towards safety. Now, of course, to start with, it can be really, really murky. So in that case, the guiding dolphin would swim ahead for a little bit to show the way, but as soon as possible, come back alongside to gently nudge. And then as soon as possible, come back behind and let that young dolphin start to make its own way. And of course, there's going to be wobbles and mistakes along the way. So again, that dance I mentioned is that the guiding dolphin will be there to come back and nudge them if they start to really go off track. But it's a lovely metaphor. And carers find that really, quite useful in terms of just that being able to reflect and think a little bit differently.
Yeah, I personally, I'm such a big fan of the animal model. I don't think it was around when I was struggling with my eating disorder, but it definitely was when I did my master's. And I actually, until chatting to you then, I didn't know about the St. Bernard. And but I love that in terms of taking that pause, because I think so often, eating disorders can pit everybody against each other and
Totally.
make you very reactive. So just taking that pause for a second, but equally allowing someone to, maybe make a mistake and then learn from it and pick themselves back up. Because one thing I do imagine, there's obviously the whole difficulty of supporting somebody through their recovery and the trauma that's involved in that and the stress that comes up. But I also imagine from a loved one's perspective, then putting your trust in your loved one that they are in a place that they can support themselves, that they're not going to fall
Totally.
back into their eating disorder. I can imagine that's quite tricky as well.
It's one of the hardest things as a supporter or a carer is letting go. because you become so hyper vigilant, so super sensitive to any hint of threat or drawback. So I do a session around relapse, for carers, which is really popular, as you can imagine. And we had a mum and a son come along and talk to one of the groups I was running, or it might have been one of the adult groups. Anyway, it was one of my topical sessions, but we were talking about relapse. And he said, one of the most difficult things.
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
Is that, say, you've just been discharged from inpatient or community care and you just want to get back on with your life. So there was that whole Netflix series, wasn't there? Everything Now, that came out, just over a year ago. That was, I think the actress was called Ruby in the series, and she wanted to do everything. She had her bucket list, didn't she? And then her parents were obviously really worried that she'd trip up and all that sort of thing. But he gave a really, really wonderful perspective from the perspective of the person who's recovering. And he said, if I'm running a marathon, I want to celebrate every mile I've run. I don't want to be worrying about the next 20 or so miles I've got to run. So he said, the most important thing, his words, which were very wise, is that as a family, you don't kind of cast this black shadow over the person of like you're just looking for signs of relapse all the time. Because that's like going right back to the beginning when you keep arguing with the eating disorder, darling, you need to eat more and exercise less. Because then the person feels under threat the whole time. And it's impossible to build any trust. So part of our model is helping care. We help carers to really try to be courageous in letting their loved ones go out and make their own mistakes, and of course then be there to catch them if they fall. But that's very different than thinking, oh, we always need to be looking for signs of this or signs of that, or because you, of course, you're going to see shadows. We'd been under the community psychiatrist for about a year, and then the community psychiatrist David was about to discharge us, and Sam was just delighted. He was fed up with all of this. He just wanted to be that normal kid back in school playing football. So that was great. He was so happy. And then Sam went out of the room, and David said to me, is there anything you're still worried about, Jenny? And I went, well, yes, he's still got all these funny habits and things. So he developed really, really extreme OCD with his starvation. And there was a lot of it was still there, even though he was weight restored. He wasn't doing the compulsive exercise because he understood that that would get in the way of him playing his good football. But tapping surfaces, tensing his muscles, stepping over cracks in pavement, walking upstairs in a certain way, walking downstairs in a certain way, all of like his day was still quite dictated by these rules, counting, muttering, all of the things that can come with starvation. And I said, well, he's still doing all of these things. So I blah, 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 blah. And David very calmly listened to me going, blah, 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 blah. And he said, well, okay, can I ask you a question? I said, of course. He said, are they doing him any harm? Not really. Like, he's back in school, he's playing football, he's good at maths, he's got loads of mates. Not really. Are they doing anyone else any harm? Yes, me, because they make me think the eating disorder's still there. And he said, which was against what was in all the books at the time. Can I make a suggestion? I know you're not going to ignore these things, Jenny, because you are hypervigilant. We know that. He said, but can I make a suggestion that you just take a step back and give it a bit of time? And he said, my prediction is that within 6 to 12 months, most of them will just go away on their own. And they did. So it was such good advice because I'd read in books, that you have to get rid of all of the eating disorder behaviors or your loved one won't be better. And of course, it doesn't work like that. I'm sure you know from your own experience that it's such a journey, isn't it? It's such a journey. And sometimes you need a break from trying to move away from something that's come with your eating disorder. That they're your safety mechanisms, and you just want to get on with having a bit of fun. And then hopefully the having the fun creates all these new lovely, joyful neural pathways, and it reduces the need for those safety mechanisms, doesn't it? So that's exactly what happened with my son. But if I hadn't had that advice, I would have been really treading on eggshells and really tiptoeing around, and probably, we would have been at loggerheads rather than moving forward together. So it was such good advice. So
Yeah.
Dodo, the psychologist, and David, the psychiatrist, I'm like, thank you, God. They were just
And
amazing.
I think that's such an interesting perspective. And I think when you understand that an eating disorder is not just about trying to lose weight or trying to control your body, you understand it's a way to survive in this world that feels like you can't survive without it. So then if you say to someone, right, that's it. All those behaviors that you've been using, they're going. Ultimately, in an ideal world, that may be what you want for a long-term goal. But if you do that to somebody immediately, and I think that's what kept happening to me and going back to the eating disorder, because my coping mechanisms kept being snatched. I've had no way of coping. I didn't know what to do. So I'd always go back. So I think, although it might feel counterintuitive, I think there's an element of knowing that the intention is not to keep them forever, the intention is to move into a recovered life where you don't rely on those behaviors. But equally, still now, sometimes I might lean into those behaviors, and it's almost a bit of a warning sign to say, oh, everything's, maybe there's something a bit off right now, rather than it being a full-blown relapse into the eating disorder. It's just a time to reflect and maybe pause and think, oh, what do I need right now?
Absolutely. And we become older and wiser. All of us. We're all lifelong learners at the end of the day, aren't we? So, somebody come, I much prefer the concept of discovery to recovery. So recovery feels quite demanding, doesn't it? And it feels like you're going back to where you were before. And I remember saying to people, I want my little boy back. And then I realized I'm not getting that little boy back. I'm getting a different boy back. And this different boy has been on an incredible journey, like a really incredible journey. And I've learned so much. He's learned so much. He's going to be coming back as different Sam. And he came back as more challenging Sam. So he was very much a pleaser before the eating disorder. So he came back as, and boy, did he challenge me through his teenage years. Still challenges me today, actually. It's quite funny. But also with so much empathy. I mean, he was still only 12 when he was discharged from the inpatient unit. And he was back in school. And I remember that there was a teacher who'd come over from South Africa, and I think he'd lost his farm and everything. It'd been a very, very difficult situation. And some of the kids were like being really, really mean about him. And Sam would stand up for him immediately and say, just remember where he's come from and what he's been through. And then Sam was very quickly football captain, and he was so empathic for any of the young footballers that were struggling for whatever reason. So he came out as a different person, and it is like you're, again, I'm sure you can relate to this, Hannah, is that you're discovering your identity without your eating disorder, and almost always it's going to be different to your identity before going into the eating disorder.
Absolutely. I have a couple of friends who we've all been through eating disorders, and we will always say, even though it's an absolutely horrific experience to go through, we are the most self-aware people that we know. Because I think you have to be, you have to really do a lot of work to understand who you are, what you value, what your morals are, what you align with, the things that you like and dislike in life. Because you have to almost, I mean, my most recent relapse, I was in recovery at about 26, and I remember saying to my partner, I'm going through puberty again. And I didn't just mean from the respect of, having a different body and things like that, but mentally, like I felt like I was going through my teen years on a super quick speed, and then all of a sudden 28 years old and learning all these things about me and life and wanting to do all the things that, somebody who's 18 year old would probably want to do. So it's very interesting, but I think it's also, I mean, it was quick for me, that pace of that change. But I equally think for my loved ones, that was also then challenging because, as we were saying before,
Yeah.
I still have it now where I'll go out for dinner with my partner and I'm so much better at going out for food now. But if I choose something that genuinely I want to have, or
Yeah.
if he says, "Shall we get starters?" and I'm like, "Oh, actually, I think I'm just going to have a main," he's still very much like, "Are you restricting?" I'm like, "I
Yeah.
genuinely am
No.
not. Like, this is coming from a very healthy place, but I've had to be very compassionate. Say, just because I can trust myself and know my intentions, it's probably going to take him a longer time to heal because he doesn't know what's going on in my brain."
Totally. Yeah. We can only guess as the, as the supporters, we can only guess. So, a big part of our model is helping carers to really see the world through the lens of their loved one. But a lot of it is guesswork. So a lot of it is about the communication and, really coming alongside and being patient and pausing and, the unconditional love and all of that. And we do some wonderful empathy exercises that really help the carers to understand, like, how when you feel under threat all the time, you're in fight flight all the time, how exhausting that might be. If somebody took away their coping strategies, they would feel the whole array of emotions like angry, sad, lost, confused, isolated. They would be tempted to do that thing behind, the person's back. So we do a lot of empathy exercises, but you can never completely understand if you haven't had your own eating disorder. And that's
Absolutely.
okay, and we teach carers to say that. It's like, well, when you get that kind of like, you just don't understand. Well, I don't understand, darling. Help me understand more.
I want to help. I want to
Yeah.
understand and I want to help. And one thing I did want to ask you about, because I think when we spoke and did our podcast together, with me, you and Harriet, we were
Yeah.
talking about dads. And
Yeah.
I do think that, parents and carers are very much often forgotten in this conversation, but I think particularly dads, and I don't know whether it is a normal thing, maybe that's the wrong phrase to say, but I know in my experience, my mum was very much the kangaroo, if we're going to talk about the animal models, occasionally the terrier, whereas my dad was an ostrich.
Yeah.
He just completely hid himself away. But what I didn't realize at the time was he was just doing research and he was
Yeah.
staying up for hours on end trying to understand. But
Yeah.
to me, that seemed as though he just wasn't really interested. And I wondered what experiences you've had with the carers group working with dads.
Yeah. So I set up a male carer group, which is predominantly dads. So I have some male brothers and grandfathers and partners, but it's mainly dads. And the reason I set it up, so the monthly carer support group I run with a wonderful single dad called Chris, who cared for his daughter Lisa when she struggled when she was at university. And so first of all, he came to our support group as a participant. And then just before COVID, I had a wobble in my life, and so he stepped in and took over the group for a while. So, his daughter's doing much better, and he's never stopped. So we co-facilitate this monthly group, and we'd notice that often, both in the workshops and in the monthly group, the mum and the dad might come together, but the dad would always defer to the mum. So the dad would actually literally physically sit behind the mum often, in the chair in on the Zoom room. So I said to Chris, shall we try this male concept of male carer group? So we meet once a quarter, and then one of the dads, Matthew, has set up a WhatsApp group, so the men all keep in contact with each other in between the call, because quarterly is not that often, is it? And then from time to time, I do a male carer series of workshops. I've just done one actually in August. So moving, like there was a grandfather and a dad came together, and it's a really special space because then the men, the males in the group, obviously I'm like the imposter, but they need me to facilitate it. But they have such a different voice and they can really open up to each other. And you know that human beings need other like-minded human beings. So just that opportunity for, especially when they first come and they say, this is the first time that I've spoken about this to a group of people who vaguely get it. Or it might be the first time they've spoken to anyone at all. And this is the first time anyone's asked me how I'm feeling. So always before my groups, I send out like a little registration form, and it asks, like, what's going on for you? How are you feeling? And they don't have to answer, but often they write me essays about how they're feeling. So that, just feeling that they matter and that they're valuable and that they're important. And so often the statement from new dads is, I really want to help, I just don't know how. And of course, now we've been doing this for a few years, there's the more, the older and the wiser male carers and dads in the group. And so you get that lovely cascade of hopefulness and stories. And yeah, I felt like that when I first came to this group. So it's such a lovely way for them all to meet and learn together. Because there's so much that dads can do, so much that dads can do. It's just helping them with that first kind of step. So one of my favorite stories about dads is we often talk about writing letters. So, and again, particularly the dads will just say it's so difficult. My daughter or my son doesn't want to talk to me. They'll talk to my wife. But often that's like being really horrible and shouting and screaming as well as the conversations. But they just don't want to talk to me. So we talk about writing letters, and there's a beautiful book called Dear Michael Love Dad. I don't know if you've come across it, by Ian Maitland, who's a journalist. And when his son became unwell, ended up in the Priory, he kept the communication going by writing endless letters. Sometimes he got a reply, often he didn't. 99% of the letters were just idle chit chat, but it kept the communication going. And then when Michael eventually got better, quite a roller coaster journey. When Michael got better, they wrote a book together, which I think they called Out of the Shadows, which is a beautiful book as well. But we often talk with the dads about, writing notes or letters or using WhatsApp rather than verbal communication, particularly to start with. Anyway, this dad came to one group, and then I sent them my piece about letter writing with lots of examples. And he wrote a letter to his daughter, but he wasn't brave enough to give it to her. So in the end, he put it on the car seat and it disappeared from the car seat. So he didn't know whether she had it or not, but he thought she might have it. And then after a month, his curiosity got the better of him. So again, when they were in the car, he was like, "Oh, darling, did you ever read that letter I wrote you?" And she said, "Oh, yes, Dad, it was the most wonderful thing, and I've got it under my pillow." Isn't that lovely? I've got
Oh.
so many stories like that.
Oh.
So another
That
one that I really want to tell,
yeah.
another dad-daughter story, is this was pre-COVID. So a couple came to my workshops in Sevenoaks, and their daughter, this was when she was a teenager and she was really struggling anyway. So they learned all the skills, and she went into that kind of quasi-recovery, emerging in, we say, like when the eating disorder's coexisting with success. So she went to university, got an amazing job, but still very much her life dictated by the eating disorder. And in the end, she was part of the Speak program that I know you're familiar with. And she invited her dad to come along to, because her dad started to be a bit more like curious of, like, I'd really like to know more about this. And he started to be able to show some of his vulnerability. And then especially when he went to a few of these speaks sessions with his daughter, he could really start to open up. And they both came to our carer support group, and they explained, and there's a lovely video of Meg on my website where she talks about this, and how bonding it was. So he would be able to say, "Well, I feel sad, darling, because at the moment you're missing out on some things that I know you want to really join in with." And they built up so much trust through this kind of shared vulnerability that then she got to the stage where she would be able to call him up and say, "Oh, I really feel like I've got an urge to purge at the moment." So, that level of trust is incredible, isn't it? So any dads listening to the podcast, just really believe in yourself. And sometimes it's the start with the WhatsApp gifts or the little post-it notes or maybe little lovely motivational cards, then maybe write a letter. And that can be such a lovely way to be able to build up that father-daughter or son connection.
Yeah, I mean, they're just absolutely wonderful stories. And I think, in my experience, I have a really good relationship with my parents, and I genuinely do think that the eating disorder has made that stronger because, as you said before, we had to come together and work on it together. But I definitely think, when I was younger and a teenager, it's that natural dynamic, I think, between a teenage daughter and a dad, and you don't really know where you sit with each other and what to share. And I sometimes felt a bit nervous, like, I don't know necessarily how to talk to my dad. And We're very close, and that's lovely. But through my most recent relapse, I had a panic attack one day, and because I just didn't know what to do with myself, and I was home alone, and nobody answered, and I just had this like feeling inside of me, like I'm gonna ring Dad. And I rang him, and I was obviously like hyperventilating and what have you, and he didn't say like, "Oh my God, what's wrong?" or anything. He just spoke, and God knows what he talked about now. But that then meant a couple of months later, I had another panic attack, and I was with my partner, and he just didn't know what to do. And so I just rang my dad, and we chatted, and he calmed me down, and I was picking blackberries whilst I was talking to him. I was then so calm. And I just reflect on those moments now, and I think, I did not know what I needed in those situations. My dad can't have really known what I needed, and he must have been panicked when he heard my voice, but he just spoke
Kept
to me
calm, yeah.
and he just held that conversation. I didn't need to necessarily say anything. He just spoke to me, and that was one of the most powerful things anyone has done for me through my recovery. So I think, like you say, if there are any dads listening, you have so much more of a role or an impact than you would ever believe. But actually, it's often just being yourself and just providing that listening ear or that distraction. It doesn't need to be big thrills. You don't need to have the answers. But I think often when people are struggling, it is just about somebody holding that space for them.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And dads can be, dads can be, what's the right word? That they're not as emotionally intertwined in the same way as the mum and the child. That
Yeah,
doesn't
I
mean
mean,
it's any better or any less. It's different, isn't it? It's different.
exactly. And I think that's a really important thing. Whether you're a sibling, a parent, a partner, a friend, there's no right or wrong way to be. I think often it is just being yourself. And whatever yourself looks like, that will have a really impactful, I was going to say impactful impact, but that doesn't really work. But you know what I mean, on
What you mean.
somebody. And I think often I just found the authenticity and that space was, that then encouraged me to feel I can be myself and I am loved and I'm cared for in those moments when, the eating disorder felt all consuming.
Yeah, totally. It's that genuineness, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think in a time where you feel, an eating disorder makes you feel so unlovable and not enough. So just to know that there are people that love you, can make, such a massive impact.
Yeah, and they're not going anywhere. Yeah. And I
Absolutely.
often say that to the, to mums who are so upset at being like the emotional pincushion for their loved one, is that, that the eating disorder is going to lash out at the person that is the most loving person because they know you're not going anywhere.
Yeah, you're a threat, basically, aren't you? So the eating disorder is trying to get rid of you. Well, Jenny, thank you so much for joining me. You are always full of so much knowledge and wisdom. So it is such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. If people want to know more about your workshops and the support that you offer, is there anywhere they can go to find out more?
Yeah, so the best place to go is probably my website, which is newmaudsleycarers-kent.co.uk. And my email is jenny at newmaudsleycarers-kent, carers-kent.co.uk. I'm sure you'll put it in the notes. But yeah, if anyone is interested, and then they just email me and I can send them all the details. And at the moment, all of our sessions are fully funded. So long may that continue. Yeah. So some of it I do on a voluntary basis. Much of it is funded by the Charlie Waller Trust. So yeah, long may that continue.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. Honestly, such a pleasure to chat to
Well,
you.
thank you for having me. Feels like I've only been here for 5 minutes.
I literally was just going to say, I don't know where that time has gone. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.